I've seen Fiddler on the Roof 3 times, which I guess says something about my age. I doubt whether a younger person would be quite that tugged, either by the melody or by the words, the lyrics of the songs. But it's the story of a little Jewish community which found itself being tossed from one area of the world to another. And the flux and flow of change kept causing the father in Fiddler on the Roof to lose his daughters to sons-in-law he thought were worthless or who came from outside the community. And all of these changes left him trying his best to cope with what was going on, but a bit sad for the process. Out of the play comes the beautiful song, Sunrise, Sunset, from which these are part of the lines. Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? Now is the little boy a bridegroom. Now is the little girl a bride. Under the canopy I see them, side by side. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears. It may seem to you the words are a little bit banal or blasé. After all, they say something we're all very much aware of. They're rescued by a haunting melody, and they come through with a great deal of beauty and touch a sensitive nerve, especially at this time of year. We're very much aware when a new year comes and an old one passes that we're getting older, that life is somehow slipping away from us. And while it may seem platitudinous to talk about it, there's usually a bit of truth buried in a platitude. There's usually a lesson to be learned from the oldest of expressions. We have our own bits of sorrow and tugging for moments of the past with nostalgia when the passing of the years does come, or the going from home of a child, as was the setting for these words. But the Bible is pretty straightforward in dealing with all of this, pretty hard-nosed. The early Christians, the Jews of the Old Testament, were very much aware of the fact that time was passing, that they were changing, their circle of friends was changing, and even the landscape around them was changing. The mountains and the hills are shaken, as you heard in the text. And they faced this. If you think of the passages you've heard perhaps on the occasion of a funeral or some of the time when an introspection was being urged from Scripture, you'll remember that the brevity of life is one of the most common themes in the Bible. Boast not thyself of tomorrow, thou knowest not what a day may bring forth. The 27th chapter of Proverbs begins by saying. Or Job says, man that is born of woman is a few days and full of troubles. He comes forth like a flower and is soon cut down. He flees also as a shadow and continues not. Isaiah says, we're like water spilt upon the ground that cannot be gathered up again. In Ecclesiastes, the final chapter, after grappling with issues of life and death, Solomon says, man goes to his long home and the mourners go about the streets. If ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the golden pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return to God who gave it. He pictures a man standing in a cistern drawing out the water of life, or having a bowl in his hand that holds the water of life, or holding on to life by a silver cord that can easily be snapped. And with all of these figures, he says, the moment comes when the dust goes back to the earth as it was, and the mourners go about the streets lamenting the person who has passed. We're all aware of this, but the Bible faces it. Not with a great deal of nostalgia, but with a great deal of anticipation. You and I have to face it too. We may be able to put it aside for a while, but there are 3 or 4 ways, and each of us chooses one of them with which to cope with it. I don't know how you've come to terms with the passing of the years or how you are coming to terms with that passing, but I'd like to single out 3 or 4 ways we most commonly do it, and for all of us to think through them and try to see exactly how we are facing sunrise, sunset. A couple of these ways are ways of saying no to the passing of time. Change isn't going to happen to me. I'll be no part of it. And a couple of the ways are ways of saying yes to the passing of time. And of course, I'm coming back to the text to find the real way to face the passing of the years. One of the ways of saying no is simply to ignore the passing of time. I don't think anybody can quite pull it off, but lots of people try it. I think in biblical times of a man named Felix, to whom Paul preached. And Acts 24th chapter says, as Paul reasoned with him about justice and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed. And he said, go away for the present. When I have an opportunity, I'll summon you. Felix seems to think, as we often do, that time isn't hurting him. He has a lot of other things to accomplish. One day he's willing to think about self-control, justice, and the future judgment. But not now. That will be at some other opportunity. It's possible for a time to ignore the passing of years, but we pay a price when we do it. Part of that price is paid in terms of honesty. You just can't build your life successfully on a fiction. And if you've assumed that you stand outside the process of time and change and that you alone are not having it happen to you, there isn't any way to face life profitably from that point of view. The person who refuses to admit that the years are taking away with their passing certain strengths he's had in the past is not in any position to gain the new strength that comes with the passing of years. There is in the Old Testament especially respect for the hoary head. The head grayed with years and filled with wisdom, a wisdom that only time can bring. There's a deep appreciation for what the years can do for a person that's profitable. But we miss all of that when we face life with the fiction that it isn't happening to us. We pay a price in terms of honesty. And we pay a price in terms of pride or a lost humility. I don't think anything is more humbling than the realization that what age is doing to someone else, it is doing in its own gradual way to me. It's easy enough for a young person to look at an older person and feel a bit of sympathy or a bit of scorn because of certain reactions that have taken place to the passing of the years. But when one first realizes, realistically, that this is happening to me too, that though I've always said that life really depends on the way you meet the troubles and not on the troubles that come to you, there may come a time when I'm not in charge of the way I meet my troubles. The realization of that can bring a certain humility. I've known person after person who was very strong in earlier years, but then illness or senility took away the very sword with which that person was fighting against what fate was doing to his life. So strong, so courageous for a time, but then ill or senile and just not able to cope responsibly with what was happening. But a realization that that's going to happen to me too brings the humility I've talked about. So we may ignore the passing of time in our own lives for a while, but when we do so at great cost. A cost in terms of honesty and not facing up to life, a cost in terms of humility we miss by forgetting that it's going to happen to us too. Another way of saying no to the passing of years is simply to defy the passing of time. You've read those articles about what happens to a person when he becomes 40. There's a great deal of truth in them. Somewhere along the line it happens. We reach that period when we think middle age is bringing only worse things. There are no better things to come. When we have to go out and prove again that we're young and we can do all the things that youth are supposed to do. Homes disintegrate. Lives are brought into rubble. Simply because a person has to prove to himself or herself that he or she is still young. It's a spirit of defiance such as one sees in the prodigal son when he says to his father, I want mine now. I'm going to live for self immediately. I'm not willing to wait. I'm not willing to be interested in family and what's being formed in my life or anything else I'll spend today. It's the spirit of defiance you see in the son in Jesus' parable in Matthew 21, 28 forward. When a man said to his sons, go work today in my vineyard, one said, I will not. Fortunately, he repented and went. But that spirit of rebellion is part of many a life. It isn't going to happen to me. I'm going to be outside the ravages of time. I think no modern person represents that better than Dylan Thomas. He died in 1953. He was a Welsh poet. By the time he was 20, a collection of his poems was published and critics recognized their brilliance. But Thomas found himself recording poems, the record selling widely, his fame spreading, giving readings of his poems across Britain and the United States. But Thomas was obsessed with the passing of the years and unwilling to take them peacefully. His fights with his wife, his problems with alcohol became widely publicized. He didn't make it to 40. At the age of 39, Thomas died while on a trip through the United States of pneumonia induced by acute alcoholism. This is a section of one of his poems where he defies the passing of years. It begins, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." And the poem ends, "And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." One may defy it for a time, but sooner or later that doesn't work either. A character in one of Peter DeVries' novels says, "I used to try to drown my sorrows until I learned they could swim." Unfortunately, some people don't learn that in time, and the efforts to drown the sorrows keep on until the person is drowned, though the sorrows are not. There's something about a spirit of defiance that may bring satisfaction for the moment, but it's not really the way to face sunrise and sunset. The biblical way is neither to ignore nor to defy, but to accept the passing of the years. There is a way, however, of accepting that passage with a sort of passivity that gives sadness to everybody around us. We admit the years are passing, we're willing for them to pass, but we're convinced that everything good is in the past. Nothing good lies in the future. One gets that spirit almost all the way through Ecclesiastes. In the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, there is a hope. The judgment is coming. God is going to bring to light every secret thing. But up until that time, one generation comes, another generation goes, the earth abides forever. It looks like man is caught up in the endless process, and he may as well accept it. Passively, there's no real hope in the future. It's the spirit one gets through most of the book of Job. Job says in chapter 14, verse 14, "If a man die, shall he live again?" That's set against the background of verse 13, where he said, "Oh, that thou wouldst remember me." Job knows that the ravages of illness and the passing of time are eating away at his life, and he pleads to be remembered by God and wonders aloud, when life is over, will I be able to live again? An acceptance of the passing of time, but a sadness that goes along with it, rather than a rejoicing in something that lies out in the future. For a modern illustration, I doubt whether any philosopher is read more widely on university campuses today than Miguel de Unamuno. Unamuno died in 1936. He had become the president of the University of Salamanca in Spain at the age of 36. A brilliant man obsessed all of his life with one fact, the fact that he was going to die. He wrote a book, one of several, called The Sense of the Tragic, or The Tragic Sense of Life. Near the end of the book, he pours out his reasons for writing. He said, "I took up my pen to distract you from your distractions." Unamuno's theory was that most of us live life out distracting ourselves from the one fact that we must die. We do everything else to forget it. But he picked up the pen to write in order to distract us from those distractions. He said, "The thought of my own soul and its eternal life tortures me. It's the palpitation of my consciousness. After death, will I live again?" Unamuno learned 18 languages so that he would be able to read the religious literature and philosophy that had been written in each of those languages originally. In his quest for the answer, when a man dies, will he live again? What comes after death? The tragic thing about Unamuno's life was that he never really found his answer. As he grew older, he said his mind was more and more convinced that it was not reasonable to expect to live after death. But his heart was more and more convinced that he had to live after death. He kept longing for life after death. And he found that struggle between his mind and his heart. It was left for a humble woman who lived in a little town outside Jerusalem talking to Jesus of Nazareth one day to hear the real answer to Unamuno's question. When Jesus said in John 11, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who lives and believes in me will never die." There is a way of saying yes to the passing of years with a great deal of sadness, and everyone who goes away from us leaves feeling that the best is gone. We're courageous, we have dignity, but only sadness as we face the future. Then there's a final way of facing sunrise, sunset. That's the way suggested by these texts. I want to reread them and add another to them, because something significant happens in these verses that the hasty reader may miss. In Psalm 102, beginning with verse 25, a passage the writer of Hebrews quotes in his first chapter, the psalmist says, "Of old thou didst lay the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thy hands. They will perish. They will all wear out like a garment. Thou changest them like raiment, and they pass away." A voice says, "Cry," and I said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades. For the mountains may depart, and the hills be removed." The very symbols of stability in our world are taken one by one. The mountains and the hills depart, they're removed, everything is broken up. Everything seems to go. But I stopped reading in each of those three paragraphs at a crucial point. I stopped before a little three-letter transitional word each of these writers used, but. And that but is set over against all of the change that takes place in our lives. All of the change is set in a context of something that does not change. Now go back to the texts again. "Of old thou didst lay the foundation of the earth, the heavens are the works of thy hands. They will perish, but thou dost endure. They will all wear out like a garment. Thou changest them like raiment, and they pass away. But thou art the same, and thy years have no end. The children of thy servants shall dwell secure. Their posterity shall be established before thee. All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. For the mountains may depart, and the hills be removed, but my steadfast love shall not depart from you, and my covenant of peace shall not be removed, says the Lord, who has compassion on you." It's the little transition word that leads to the real way to pass from year to year, to face the process of change, the flux and flow of time, sunrise, sunset. One may ignore it, one may defy it, but he's going to pay a price, and he isn't going to succeed. One may accept the passing of the years with sadness and be no richer for them. Or one may realize that while the years take away their strength, they also give another kind of strength. And they're set in the context of something they can never take away. God endures forever. His word stands forever. And his covenant he will not break. You see, the whole of the Christian religion is here to say that man is special. He's the crowning work of God's hand. The time and history are where God is doing his own creative work. And therefore, every man's life lived out in time and history is special, is important. Sure, that's the little girl you carried. And that's the little boy at play. And you may not remember growing older, but they do. We all do. There's no way to stand outside it. But there is a way to be enriched by it. And that's in that covenant, obeying that word, being submissive to that God. Would you do his will while we sing? I have two things to announce briefly. We didn't have a bulletin this week. We will have the coming week, and they'll both be in it. But I'd like you to have an earlier reminder. One of them is that several people in the last several months have asked me when and whether I was going to repeat the sermon here, which is called The Impossible Dream. It doesn't take a lot of prompting, I guess. This is the 75th time I've done it, but I'm going to preach it next Sunday morning at 8 and at 10. And I thought you might want to know in order to invite some friend to come who would come for a special occasion perhaps and wouldn't come on another occasion. The other announcement is that we're asking the congregation to engage in an unusual project in the coming year that I think will be rewarding to as many of us as will cooperate. We're going to read the Bible through together in 1976. I don't know a better way to celebrate a bicentennial year. It's been 7 years since the congregation here did a project like this together. Those of you who were here then, just take my word for it. It was 7 years ago. Those who weren't here, we're glad you're going to be part of the process. We're going to use a very simple formula. You can always remember it. You read 3 chapters a day and 5 chapters on Sunday. That makes a long day on Sunday. But it really isn't that long if you do it systematically. If you get behind, it's kind of hard to catch up. But that means that Thursday you need to start by reading Genesis 1 through 3. Sunday night sermons throughout 1976 will be coordinated with the Bible readings, which is to say next Sunday night the sermon will be on Genesis. And after you've had time to read Genesis, we'll have a sermon on Exodus and so on. So that the combination of your reading and the Sunday evening services should help us to do a bit of growing in Bible knowledge during the year. I hope you'll take it seriously, perhaps get a new copy of the Bible or take one you don't mind marking in, perhaps a different translation, something that will stimulate your reading, and read along with us beginning Thursday of the coming week. Mott Jones has an announcement.
Brother Orman, chairman of our elders, has asked me to bring the following message to you as a congregation. The piece of property just 3 doors down from us is for sale, and a contract has been given by one of the fraternities over at Memphis State University. The neighborhood has a petition circulating throughout the neighborhood asking that the neighbors sign it because they do not want the fraternity being built in this neighborhood. They have asked us as a congregation if we will join them in circulating a petition among the congregation and you all signing the petition saying that you are against a dormitory being built 3 doors down from us. I think all of you know what probably would happen, well, likely will happen, if the dormitory is built there. I would like to read to you what the petition says. We, the undersigned members of Highland Street Church of Christ, hereby petition against a special permit being granted for dormitory use of property on the west side of Highland Street, 400 feet north of Midland. On Friday of this week, January 2, in the council chambers, there will be a meeting at 1 o'clock. all of you that can attend, we would appreciate it if you could be there. These petitions will be at the exits, all four exits, and if you'd sign them, we would certainly appreciate it. Thank you.
Our closing hymn is number 64. Would you stand together as we sing?
Here we are, but straying pilgrims, here our path is often dim. But to cheer us on our journey still, we sing this wayside hymn. Yonder over the rolling river, where the shining mansions rise, soon will be our home forever, and the smile of the blessed giver gladdens all our longing eyes. Here our feet are often weary on the hills that throng our way. Here the tempest darkly gathers, but our hearts within us say, yonder over the rolling river, where the shining mansions rise, soon will be our home forever, and the smile of the blessed giver gladdens all our longing eyes. Here our souls are often fearful of the pilgrim's lurking foe, but the Lord is our defender, and he tells us we may know. Yonder over the rolling river, where the shining mansions rise, soon will be our home forever, and the smile of the blessed year.